listening to the Human Growth Foundation's Endocrine Education Podcast, where healthcare providers and caregivers take a deeper dive into growth and bone disorders, as well as growth hormone deficiency treatment options with our special guest experts.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us today for the Human Growth Foundation podcast. I'm joined today by Dr. Anil Pia. Dr. Pia and I both are pediatric endocrinologists. Dr. Pia is going to talk today about an interesting case that he's encountered of pseudohypoparathyroidism and also talk to us a little bit about the journey and experience as a pediatric endocrinologist in diagnosing and treating this condition. Before we get into the case, though, I'd like to give Dr. Pia an opportunity to tell us a little bit about yourself.
All righty. Thank you, Dr. Stillman. So it was a wonderful, thank you for your nice introduction. And I'm very happy and glad to be a part of this Human Growth Foundation. And on top of it, I'm very glad to talk a little bit about me and what I'm doing here and some of the interesting kids or the cases that I've seen around in the last couple of years. And so I'm happy to discuss about a pseudohypoparathyroidism and whatever I have experienced, whatever I've got it, I've just let it out. So
great.
So I'm Anil Pia again. I'm the pediatric endocrinologist here down in Savannah, Georgia. So interestingly, in the first, when I came down here, I started in an academic institute, basically, and I worked for 5 years to a point where I said, okay, it's time for me to kind of start my own. So I'm in private practice now for the last 4 years. And during my journey, I've learned a lot. I've learned from the academics. I've learned from my private practice standpoint. So it'll be a mix of all. And I do have a couple of interesting kids that I'm happy to share here.
The purpose of our podcasts are really to sort of highlight and give people, rather than just a straightforward type of lecture on a condition, but kind of talk about it a little bit from the standpoint of sort of being immersed from the various standpoints, whether it's a standpoint of diagnosis and treatment, you know, from the standpoint of the medical field to talking to families. That's kind of the goal for our podcast here, and hopefully to provide a little bit more insight in all of these areas. So tell us, I guess, before talking about the case, I guess, tell the audience the diagnosis of pseudohypoparathyroidism, the condition.
So if you have to understand pseudohypoparathyroidism, it's a little bit of a longest, I think it's one of the few longest word in the medical or whatever, you know, in the literature. But basically what it means is like it's a heterogeneous group of disorder, we call it, where it has features of hypoparathyroidism basically. But the parathyroid hormone is intact. Parathyroid hormone is perfectly working. It's just that it does not work in the end organ. So basically we call it parathyroid hormone resistance in the organ or where the receptor is not clicking. And so it does come up with a variety of presentation, as I said, you know, it's a heterogeneous group of disorder. And again, it's very rare. Again, it's 0.2 to 1.1 per 100,000 population, again, depending on the geographic or depending on the location. But it's very important that we may miss this interesting, or we call it a rare condition, in their early life, and it can make a big impact. We can identify or, you know, detect it early. And so, yes, the patients initially, when they come in, they present with variety. Again, they're subdivided into various types. But again, and our focus mainly would be on the type 1 A, which is more we see in commonly in the our endocrinology practice. But it could be missed in the primary care providers' practices. And again, the families may be also missing, or maybe wondering what's going on with kids, and we can identify early if we can understand, or we can kind of look at the features and try to bring it to doctors' attention, or even doctors can bring it to endocrinologist's attention. And when they're born, they look absolutely normal. When they come in out of, they look normal, but suddenly they can present with hypoglycemia. And there are some interesting kiddos, they present with glycemia for a reason I also cannot explain exactly why, but they do present. They can present. And so, and then they present with, we call it congenital hypothyroidism. And so we all start treating as hypothyroidism, whereas whereas we kind of do not get in the picture or does not alert us about anything about this. As they continue to grow, you will start noticing massive weight gain for no reason, just drinking milk and just regular feed, and families get frustrated and wonder what's going on with my child. That's what happened to one of my kids, one of my child that came in very early, massive and extreme obesity, along with their size is like Michelin baby. And literally, families get so basically they get so worried, and with all these people looking at the family members, stigmatizing what's going on, you know, with the weight gain, and so
sure.
That puts the family into tremendous amount of stress. And we as a provider, sometimes we don't look at it seriously and understand what's going on, instead of just throwing out insensitive comments about saying some different, you know, words, even though we don't mean to say that, but just, you know, you have to understand very sensitively that they come with all the stress. And so whenever they come with early onset obesity with massive appetite, we with congenital hypothyroidism always have to have this back in my back of our mind that, hey, is this something normal? So
It would seem, you know, like you point out very rightly, you can see, you know, it can be very subtle sometimes, but certainly in infancy, it sounds like some of the clues that might sort of point you in the direction would be things like early hypoglycemia or, you know, I've seen this as well too, you know, congenital hypothyroidism that ultimately turns out. And also too, you know, it's a challenge as a, you know, in the medical field regardless, but certainly in endocrinology with the epidemic of obesity in children, it's hard sometimes to determine, you know, what might be caused by something, you know, that's an underlying condition like pseudohypoparathyroidism or hypoparathyroidism, for instance, versus, you know, just the more prevalent out there in the community, you know, factors such as less activity and you know, higher calorie meals. Is there anything else, though, that you see particularly early on? Because it, like you pointed out, I mean, earlier onset obesity in kids does kind of perk up the ears and to wonder, is there something else going on? But is there anything else you've noticed early on that could be some clues for the medical community or for families? You know, they're noticing that their child's kind of depart, not quite, you know, on an average track.
Correct. And so what happens is that as they grow, then you start noticing, and then what happens is that at that time, no matter how much thyroid hormone or we replace that, sometimes they get a heavy dose of thyroid hormone, which we wonder, why is this child requiring so much?
Right, and so then, quite a bit more than you'd expect. Okay, that makes sense.
And then when we look at the child, no matter what, you know, the child continues to grow, and child continues to put on weight to a point where there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of anxiety. And we rarely tends to do any workup, especially if it's coming from the primary. Basically, it's going to be more of a thyroid hormone. But as we start to see much weight gain, then we'll start to work up obesity workup. And so baseline workup of obesity, we as an endocrinologist, we all start with basically, you know, calcium, vitamin D, and parathyroid disorder. Or, you know, we have to rule out. And so that's our basic workup. You know, when they are not in that heavyweight category, we may even miss that when we start early evaluation, when we don't see that you know, increase in their weight. And so that's when, you know, initial biochemical presentation would be, as we are treating hypothyroidism, we see massive or we see increase in a very elevated parathyroid hormone level. And some people can present with hypocalcemia, but
Mm-hmm.
The calciums are in the lower side, but the PTS is pretty much, you know, very high. It starts to go up, and you also starts to notice creeping high phosphorus level in your blood. And so that's how you kind of start thinking, okay, there is an elevated PTS and there is a low calcium, but again, the phosphorus is high. You know, right. Usually with a high PTS, the phosphorus should be low.
That's
and
correct.
That's
yeah.
when yeah. we start, and that's how we diagnose. And that's what typically they are detected usually in the mid infancy or even later part of their life in a couple of years is included in my, one of my patients was diagnosed at around 3 years of age, even mm-hmm. though, you know, I was following this patient because we did not have genetic testing at that time. So that's what happens. And then, you know, they continue to grow. They have some issues with eating as they grow massive. They're hungry all the time. And then, as I said, their maturity, you know, if you run their overall, you know, Their bone maturity is also advanced. As I said, you know, they can show some subtle signs of puberty, but basically puberty is not much. It could be even a little bit in the delayed side, but basically the bones are matured. And some people come with growth hormone resistance. Again, this is basically a heterogeneous group of disorders where there's multiple G protein or receptor resistance, right? So again, the growth hormone, there is can be a resistant, and they can develop adult short stature again, you know, when they are growing faster earlier. And some people are just growth hormone not making enough. And some people have that issues. And they become short, basically, from the very right. early. And we may have to intervene by, you know, thinking about growth hormone. And most importantly, as they're going to school, that's very important when we start noticing cognitive, neurocognitive impairment. They do okay. have difficulties holding their pen, their pencils or whatever, you know, they're carrying and they're drawing. So the motor issues has been, and the coordination issues can be a problem too, or the coordination between. And so, and plus their attention, their focus is going to be a problem as this resistant level is going to be at the brain. And so, again, as I said, these are a variety of presentations, and you know, which can be again from the brain all the way to their bones, all the way to their, you know, fat growth, thyroid hormone, and again, we said the calcium mm-hmm. and the parathyroid or kidney level. Yeah, okay. and then later on, they may also have a presentation along with their there's some, you know, greediness underlying or underneath their skin. That can be some calcium deposition there. Yeah.
Right. When you have someone where they're referred to you and you have a suspicion for pseudohypoparathyroidism, what are some of the things that you look at in kind of the three domains that we all look at medically? So the domain of medical history. I know you said, you know, given kind of a list, but kind of think about it from the standpoint if someone's in your office. So the domain of medical history that kind of raises your radar that there may be a problem, the physical findings that you might see on your exam, and then the lab, you know, kind of some besides the calcium and the phosphorus, which you've already mentioned, other lab studies that might give you clues that this is what you're dealing with. And then also, you know, lastly, any genetic, you know, talk about when you make the decision to do genetics.
Right. Again, you know, typically, you know, they present with early onset obesity. Again, as I said, you know, of course, they present with congenital hypothyroidism. Then we start treatment. That's how they land up in the endocrinology office. But sometimes, you know, there could be family practitioners taking care of it and trying to take care of the hypothyroidism on their own. And the presentation, again, as I said, is going to be, that's based on my experience, is going to be more of a weight gain to mm-hmm. a point where they've done everything right, but still there's massive weight gain, massive growth in the body or growth in their body. We may subtly see as they grow signs of, you know, the bone signs in our examination, but basically they look a little bit massive. You know, they're like, you know, people will look at them and, you know, people get a little nervous when they look at them. It's like kind of the family is going to be really questioning themselves what's going on. I think that's what I've noticed based on what I've seen and my experience. Again, there is a variety of presentations they come with. But that's, I would say, is early onset obesity. Whenever you see that, again, we are there to help. If somebody misses congenital hypothyroidism or they may not present early with that, the weight gain is the big one for the pseudohypothyroidism, parathyroidism type 1, the one the more common one is. Whereas some people may not even present with all these features, where they could be absent of all these features, the one we are talking about again. So these features that we are talking about, you know, obesity, like round faces, short neck, again, they can have an early presentation, or precocious puberty can be a presentation, you know, from the very beginning. And again, they're going to start shunting their fingers. We call it their brachydactyly. They're going to have a short metacarpal.
So short fingers, yeah.
Yeah, short fingers could be a sign, again, as I said. And then, you know, so those are the things that will, and again, cognitive impairment, they're you know, processing in schools, their learning can be affected. Mm-hmm. And there are some kids who have been backed from schools, and schools could not take care of them just because of their, you know, learning and some behavior issues that can be associated with this. And again, this is a very challenging. That's why this is a multidisciplinary approach that we have to go through this challenging condition. But again, yes, they are very classic looking. You know, they may even look like a moon-faced kids. You know, with
so almost features, like Cushing, somewhat in some
like
ways,
more of a Cushing's as well. Right. And again, as an endocrinologist, we always do our, you know, short metacarpal, how we call it, the spelling, the, what do you call that sign again?
The knuckle sign.
The knuckle sign that we call it, right? That's very important. And that's what I teach medical students. And then I tell the family members why I'm doing these tests. And they wonder, and I, you know, it's fun. It's actually in the office to talk about what we are doing, which typically they don't do it in the regular office visits and all that. So it's interesting at the same time. But again, because of that, the heterogeneous or the presentation, it could be so different in different kids, and it differs person to person or patient to patient. So that's how I would do. But the most important thing is if you can detect it early. And nowadays, in terms of investigation, we do have some genetic testing for obesity that is available, or we would say more of a sponsored test. Or there are some commercial tests that I really have a threshold to always do that. And especially when I see that elevated parathyroid hormone with their self, those features that they have, I go after that test, basically. And that's how we can confirm this condition. And that's good that, you know, one of my patients was diagnosed based on the genetic testing that was available from some sponsored testing group. So that's one thing that will help us understand. But there's not all, you know, genes are, or not all pseudohypoparathyroidism detected by the genetic testing, which is, again, the challenge. But again, those kids may not quite present with obesity. Interesting, one of my kids, which I have a type 1B, is pretty much a healthy, normal weight child who just present with some bony changes and biochemical changes of pseudohypoparathyroidism. So that's very interesting, which we can talk about further. But when they present with early onset obesity, that would be always in my mind that, hey, let's not think that this is just overfeeding or overnutrition. This could be a rare genetic condition that we can detect and start treatment on conditions that we can help the families and the child.
What about, the process of making the diagnosis can be one that's can be long. And of course, as you mentioned, it's very important to try to make the diagnosis as early as you can. Talk to us a little bit about the treatment that you prescribe, or the different treatment options that are out there. And also, I guess, a little bit about just talking to families about, you know, the diagnosis and helping to prepare them to sort of know what to expect with their child.
And so, first of all, we tell them, you know, yes, we cannot be judgmental right now. We cannot stigmatize weight gain. And that's where we pretty much be all endocrinologists, I think, are on the same page in terms of that. And it takes time to help people understand that not all obesity is just due to diet and exercise or just, you know, poor, you know, feeding or overfeeding, whatever you call it, right? And the kid is lazy or whatever you call it. But basically, what I would do is, you know, in these multi-organ problem that they have, again, for the hypothyroidism, we start on levothyroxine from day one, and their dose requirement goes up. So there's a close monitoring by checking their hormone level, the TSH and T4, we call it, to start with. And then we just go up on the dose, try to kind of bring it down, the TSH level, as much as we can with preventing over-treatment at the same time. And in terms of their problem, basically, as I said, this is the high parathyroid hormone, low calcium, right? And the parathyroid is not working at the end organ. So basically, the calcitriol would be the one that we need to start with. Even though there's less conversion, we may see a low calcium or low calcitriol or low active form of vitamin D, 125 hydroxy vitamin D. We would like to replace it from outside so that we can bring the parathyroid hormone down, or we can lower than the parathyroid, the elevated parathyroid hormone levels, so that there's not a whole lot of bone activity going on. And hopefully we can bring down the phosphorus also down. So giving the calcitriol along with, we may require some calcium supplement at the same time. And some endocrinologists, some start with 125 hydroxy vitamin D, and we may also have to add a 25 hydroxy vitamin D together with it. But we may need to be really generous in starting it in terms of the dosing, and the dosing may go up, really up as we treat, as we see, or as we don't see much, you know, control of the parathyroid hormone and much lowering of the phosphorus level. And so we just have to be careful while we are treating them, try to maintain it. And we don't want to overtreat to a point where there's too much of calcium and then the kid is peeing out or, you know, excreting calcium, leading to other complications of, you know, calciuria. So we just have
to be mindful. Like kidney stone risk.
Exactly. Like giving the kidney stone. So, And so we have to be mindful on how we manage, and we have to be careful and monitor very closely. That's why their follow-up is pretty much, you know, closely monitored, closely followed up in their endocrine office. And now, in terms of behavioral and cognitive issues, again, these are something that are of our field. And so we coordinate with their primary care provider to make sure that there is a cognitive evaluation done by a psychologist or, you know, so that in the school also kind of go over that with their family and come up with some kind of plan, which they have to go through that. And some, and we see some good outcome from them, from the family, from the kids in their school activities and all. Now, regarding their growth, again, some kids, we have to be careful in where their growth is. And we have to evaluate for growth hormone deficiencies, as I said, you know, when their growth has been compromised. And so we have to be careful, and they may require growth hormone. But again, the challenging part here is that not everybody gets growth hormone. They have to meet strict criteria for starting growth hormone, and that's been always a challenge for us. Luckily, some of my kids who have not required growth hormone, they have been, you know, the strong family history of tall stature or being tall in the family, that has been an advantage from some of my kids, and they have been doing great. And luckily, even though they look very, you know, mature and their bones are advanced, we get worried to a point where they may become short as an adult.
Right.
But close monitoring for their bone maturity, their growth is important at the same time. Now, regarding the obesity, again, as I said, you know, for now, as far as I know, I'm not sure if there's anything is available to address the obesity. But most importantly, it's their excessive hunger. We call it an hyperphagia. That's where we have noticed it a lot in kids. They constantly focus on food, whatever they can, steal foods. That's what typically I've seen in a couple of kids that I have in my practice, and very interestingly, And so we just have to deal with that, trying to prevent other comorbidities, especially diabetes is a risk factor here. So we have to work with them closely with the nutrition team and just come up with a solid plan in terms of what their meal's going to be like. Letting family know that this is what they're going to do. And, you know, like we treat for other genetic conditions that has too much of appetite, they constantly focus on food. So I think what I've noticed in some of my patients that I've seen is that's what we've been doing, and that has helped. Helping them be organized in terms of planning and all that, and family being on top has helped them. And whatever it is, and they're young, they do tend to kind of improve their weight later on during their early, you know, adolescence or during their adolescence, which is, again, interesting again. And so that's what I've seen some of my kids is like, oh, there I've been. And so their families also get excited. But at the same time, just have to be a little careful about it in terms of long-term managing management of their weight gain and, you know, monitoring their tests for diabetes, monitoring their cholesterol levels, and making sure there is no any changes, fatty liver changes. So those are the things that we'll definitely monitor in the office while they are, you know, under our long-term care.
Let me ask you this: as far as, you know, building a team of, you know, medical team to kind of help follow the children and families who have pseudohypoparathyroidism, what, you know, besides the endocrinologist, which I, and again, I'm being a little bit, you know, biased here that I think, you know, endocrinology and being a pediatric endocrinologist, that we really do play a central role. But who else do you find in the medical team, like maybe dietitian or other people that can be helpful?
Right. As I said, exactly. So as this is something we have to use a multidisciplinary approach in addressing this. So that, again, includes from neurocognitive, addressing the neurocognitive issues where they may need a thorough evaluation, starting from school nurses or the school evaluators, from there to a psychologist where they need to do a full evaluation for that and come up with their plan. And for that, we just have to, as you said, you know, we are pretty much the coordinator or the, you know, the core or the provider that pretty much plays a big role in helping all this. And again, we're not saying that our primary care providers are not going to help. It's basically just that how complex it is and how difficult it is to kind of keep up all that. Most of the time, it's the pretty much the endocrinologists. We are the ones who are kind of coordinating the care with other providers. And we're there always happy to talk to the school team, talk to, you know, their psychologist, like talk to any, it could be a nutrition team, and come up with a plan. Again, as I said, it could be all these multidisciplinary specialties that we need to approach and help them address the needs.
Well, let me ask you, as far as when, I guess, to as we're wrapping up here, tell me a little bit about, you know, some things that you have some hope for as far as, you know, advances in the care for pseudohypoparathyroidism, and also just maybe one or two things that you've found as far as advice that you've given to families that have been really impacting.
That's a very good question. I think Dr. Stillman would know more than me in terms of the recent development going on. I know there are a lot of, you know, big players in nationally, like, you know, we have one of our own, you know, Human Growth Foundation member who is very actively, not only member, she is she was our secretary. And now, you know, she's always been actively involved in this Human Growth Foundation and being an advocate for our kids.
Right.
She's one of our national players. And I think the question would be basically, this is something we are evolving. This is something that's going on. And it's a challenge to find out exactly one condition, because this is such a heterogeneous presentation. And again, as far as I know, I probably would have to ask, or I have not quite updated in terms of what could be going on in the pipeline right now in terms of development of one kind of, treatment or some kind of, modalities or some kind of, path to,
right,
addressing or cure or treat. But again, as far as whatever I've known, basically is trying to address the current, the need or current presentation they present with, and just trying to address that. Dr. Stillman can add more onto this, I'm sure.
We'll try. We have our expert guidelines that have been put out, which are very helpful and certainly help to guide and inform me when I take care of kids. What about if you had maybe one or two things that you offer? I mean, I know that it's been very important, and I think it's very key to, continue to talk about the issue of just healthy lifestyle and activity. But are there any other things besides that area maybe that you find that are kind of some things that families really appreciate when they're working with you as far as advice that they think feel is impacting to them and successful?
And I think the number one key factor, what I've learned from my academic as well as from my private practice is primarily we have to put ourselves in their shoes. And a lot of times you sometimes tend to kind of deviate ourselves or whatever. There could be multiple reason behind that. But I think it's all about listening to them, trying to get where they are, and trying to kind of even just listening and trying to feel it would pretty much, cut half of their questions or, anxiety or stress or whatever it is. And then let them understand, let them know that this is the condition. It's still what we do, still don't understand fully about it. We are working on it. It is the excessive hunger, the increased appetite that can cause this. You just have to be careful in terms of how we handle this with the challenging kids. Again, there could be behavioral issues along with all this, right? So it's adding more challenges for the family. So listening, helping them understand that disease condition, this is appropriate for this disease condition. We just have to be patients, and we just have to be following the instructions from our nutritionist, instruction, whatever the plan is, instruction from what we have given, and hope for the better and hope to see if we can do something about the appetite. And if you ask me if there's anything that would be possible, especially for the type 1As or somebody who has early onset obesity, who has massive hunger, is something we can talk about is weight losing treatment options, something that we may have to look into this and see if there's anything that would be helpful for them at their early stage of their disease or this condition. So that would be something I would definitely work on. Another one is the growth hormone treatment. We need to advocate for this. We need to do more studies to see why some kids are, grow without growth hormone and some kids fail, and where we have to be on top and try to get, or as much as we can, growth hormone treatment option. Put that in for kids who we can help by giving growth hormone. Again, these are very individual. That's something we need to work more on. We need to bring it into more surface and then see the results. Without that, it's going to be very hard. Now, in terms of the other treatment that we are doing, pretty much we are good with that. But now, in terms of focusing on their overall, is the multiple, system that is involved in the family that takes a lot of their time, energy, and all that. And I think it's all about letting them know that this is not only our patient, this is something that typically happens, and we just have to be taking one step at a time and, trying to address it in a very, a manner where, where we can be successful in long-term treatment on this and help in the research for pseudohypoparathyroidism.
Thank you. Very good. Well, as we wrap up here, I just want to thank you for taking time to join us, and also for the people listening to this podcast for giving us a listen. Please come back and join us again for future podcasts as we highlight other endocrine conditions and conditions impacting growth and bone.
Thanks for listening to the Human Growth Foundation's Endocrine Education Podcast. To listen to previous podcasts, please visit hgfound.org/podcasts.